In this episode of The Critical Myth, the Critical Myth crew gets radioactive with Manhattan and wraps the week with quick hits. It's episode 490. Critical Myth gets Ebola.
Episode 490 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I've always found things go faster when you work together. In subterfuge, there we go.
Yeah, and while the fall season has apparently killed off the rest of our team, it may have been radiation exposure. I'm not sure. One of those two. But unfortunately, well, Gary had to drop out because he's got the illness of American fall, and Bronstum has the wonderful illness of Australian spring.
Yes, and we haven't found out yet if it's all in their head.
It may be. It may be. Let's put it this way. I've been suffering from horrible allergies all week, and I feel better than either one of those. So we're just all in great shape. And that's all being said as we are looking at having a week off next time because I'll be at New York Comic Con. So, yeah, woo! Mm-hmm. We're just batting 1,000 right now. It's been a very strange August and September, or even going back to July, where we've had some weeks with just two episodes. Just because the content just varies wildly. That said, we're going to, of course, go into the last of this week's news items and then into our typical episodic discussion. But first, Edmund, if you don't mind doing the usual.
Absolutely. I need to warn everyone that we will discuss just about anything that might have happened in the world, on TV, probably not in our personal lives, which we try and draw the line somewhere, but about those other things, you will definitely be spoiled. But as always, we wait a week or so before we do that to you.
That's right, that's right. And we are going to go ahead and start off with a little bit of genre news. And I'll get started. I wanted to throw this out there for Gary. I kind of wish I could have gotten his feedback on this one. But here we go. Star Wars Rebels renewed for season 2 ahead of its television premiere. That's right, before even one bit of Rebels has hit the air.
Wow.
It's already been renewed for season 2. Not all that big of a surprise. Disney has made it very clear that they have a long-term plan for the Star Wars franchise, and so why would we expect them to hesitate at all to have this flagship animated show run for at least 2 seasons? I think they knew they were doing this anyway.
Yeah, and I do find it interesting that there's this whole trend of early renewals has started migrating from the cable networks to the more, shall we say, more conventional networks. This might be a bit of a special case because Disney is well aware of what they've got with Star Wars. So, you know, this unlike some of the early missteps like Sci-Fi and Flash Gordon, this is one that certainly makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that I recall is that when they were talking about putting together, when Lucas was still in charge of his franchise, a live-action Star Wars show, mm-hmm. that I think the concept actually turned into this, but at any rate, that he didn't even want it to hit the air until the entire series was shot, edited, and packaged and ready to go, and it would have been a multi-season show. So, I mean, it's not out of the practice for the franchise to feel like they've got to have their ducks in a row before they put everything on the air. And, you know, as we put this out, the Rebels show has already started, and we'll, of course, see what maybe Gary thinks of that, the actual material. But for right now, it's interesting to see them go down that route. All right, so switching gears a little bit, and we talked about this a couple shows back, but a little bit more information. X-Men Apocalypse, a lot of noise coming out of that production, I guess you could say, or the early stages of pre-production. It's going to have fun with the 80s, they say, which makes perfect sense.
Of course.
We all saw that coming. And it's going to explore the relationship between Mystique and Beast. And actually, what I saw in a lot of other places was that this is going to focus even more on Mystique than Days of Future Past did. which to which I said, of course, you're going to maximize the Jennifer Lawrence in blue body paint as much as you can.
Of course.
While she's still under contract. but come on, you know, first class, 60s, mm-hmm. Days of Future Past, 70s. Where did they think Apocalypse was going to be?
Exactly.
And what better time frame to have the word apocalypse attached to it? But anyhow, it might maybe Children of the Atom would have made equal sense at one point, especially in the 60s. But so they're looking at this as the close of the first class trilogy, so to speak, kind of the sub-trilogy within the larger context that they've now created, bridging the two franchises together. And yeah, of course, the fact is that Jennifer Lawrence is going to probably be hard to get after this.
Yes. I think that's a reasonable assumption.
Yes. Why don't you go ahead then and take the next one?
Absolutely. We apparently will be seeing even more of the Flash than we expected. It's now been confirmed that the CW has actually added about 3 minutes to the runtime of the pilot, and apparently this is including stuff that has not been seen in any of the previews at Comic-Con, and more importantly, on that version that some people might have seen when it leaked out over the summer. I actually think this is quite a canny move given that leak, not that most of us weren't going to watch it again anyway, but to just sort of make, you know, an interesting way of dealing with that situation where people have seen it already, but just make sure that they are well aware that no, that there is stuff that they haven't seen, and a reason to tune in to the CW Tuesday at 8 o'clock.
Well, yeah, and you know, of course, again, this will have already been on the air by the time this goes out. But yes. One of the things that I like about this is we've seen situations where the productions have intentionally put out the pilot well beforehand. I think Caprica was the most egregious example of this, where it may have backfired tremendously on them to put out the pilot ahead of time. And I think that they kind of knew that they had to do something to give people a reason to show up on the first night. Otherwise, if they felt like they had already seen it, why bother? Tune in for the second episode. And I feel like it would have gotten a very bad start in the ratings. It may still struggle a little bit in that regard, but this gives people, like you said, a reason to show up. I know I'll be there.
Oh yeah,
so that's worthwhile.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to, and it should be mentioned as well that, of course, I mean, even though while some of us may feel that we're sort of in a community where now a lot of people have seen it, there are also a lot of people who either don't wish to or don't have access to those alternate means who will be showing up as well. So
absolutely. All right, and the next one, which I will have to very quickly turn off the video that is going to start if I don't. I think I got to it in time. Yes. Okay. All right. Oh, boy. And, okay. Yeah. So you remember that I Am Legend movie that came out, I think, maybe 7 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Will Smith.
Yes.
Kind of a
The really funny thing about this is that I've actually avoided it all these years, except happened to run across the closing sequence on cable the other day.
Now, I will say this. I think the people who saw it would largely agree the first half of the film, really good.
Mm-hmm.
It falls apart after that.
Yeah.
However, apparently Warner Brothers sees this as a potential franchise and has decided to reboot I Am Legend. Yes, only 7 years after the last iteration of this story.
Yes.
This story has been done so many times.
Mm-hmm.
Can't we just let it go?
Yeah.
And what about this says franchise to anybody?
It's about the end of the world.
Yes. Okay.
And I mean, unless you're being really imaginative and it's about, you know, that, it's about the end of the world and then you're going to show society rebuilding itself, but that's not really the way, that doesn't really sound like a studio franchise film series.
No, you see, what it's going to be, it's like watching The Road and saying at the end of it, you know what this movie really needs? A sequel.
Yeah. It needs a longer road, yes.
Yes, it needs the highway. Yeah. All right. Let's close this out a little bit better. A little bit would be the word that we would perhaps use after our discussion a couple episodes back.
Yep.
But Gotham has cast Harvey Dent.
Yes, indeed.
Two-Face. The actor from Masters of Sex, Nicholas D'Agosto.
D'Agosto, I believe.
D'Agosto, okay. Whatever. Is apparently going to be playing Harvey Dent. And this is, again, one of these weird things where it's like, okay, so that character was in the Nolan Dark Knight trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
Was almost one of the iconic on-screen versions of the character. And yet here we see that character being portrayed in Gotham, but Batman still is not. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we've gone on and on about that.
Yeah, and again, we'll be still seeing him as the lawyer he was before he becomes Two-Face, presumably.
So one would presume. However, there are indications that perhaps that's not the case. But we'll see. We'll see. Another indication the show is still going to try and have its cake and eat it too. Or what would be the opposite of that? Not having cake.
Yes.
And chewing anyway? I don't know. Yeah. I'm not sure. What I do know is that
wanting cake but not having it.
There you go. We are going to take our break before we talk about our episode discussion, so stay tuned.
Yeah.
All right, so unfortunately, Gary could not join us for this discussion, but we have one other show that we consider to be like a major topic that we want to cover here. We have a couple episodes of it, and that would be Manhattan. All right, and that would be Manhattan, Season 1, Episode 9, Spooky Action at a Distance. Frank and Charlie hatch a plan.
They really did hire the AMC.
They did.
Promo writers, didn't they?
The recap is shorter than the title.
Yes.
I'm just saying. All right. Well, at least they made a nice reference to Einstein.
Yes, they did.
Okay, let's see as I try to find the spreadsheet where I put in our scores is getting ridiculously huge with the number of tabs for each show. But anyhow, what would you give this episode?
I will give this an 8.5.
Okay. And I think I'll stick with my usual 8.
Okay.
Well, I'll let you go ahead for a little bit because, again, I usually would let you and Gary go forward with this, but he's not here.
Yeah.
Highlight for this one.
Well, so it's... Certainly, in terms of the sort of historical stuff, finally pushing forward. I mean, this whole, you know, seeing this whole plan to keep implosion on track by secretly commandeering and subverting the little man group I've liked the way that was being laid out, they were absolutely staying true to the fact that no, these are smart people you're trying to hoodwink. So of course, Helen is going to catch wind of it pretty quick. Especially coming in as the as his deputy. So unlike the scientists who are getting the little chunks doled out to them, and of course, given the fact she was already working on it, she can pick up on it rather quickly. The continuing partnership with Frank and our explosives expert has been rather fun to watch. I mean, having this as opposed to the more buttoned down or neurotic or just plain on the verge of falling apart, it seems, with Frank, just having this guy who's more the outlier and the very much the wild card, I thought has shaken things up nicely. And Peter Stormare is rather good at doing that over the top character. He's actually been showing up on the Blacklist as well as the big villain. But I've been actually much more entertained by what he's been doing on Manhattan, and also on the private life side of things, the way that they've been parsing out Abby's little affair, and I thought it's been some rather interesting developments, and I think rather well written and acted, and certainly is bringing up an element of just what's going to happen when you isolate people like this, and they may be in situations where they're not that happy in their private lives, and we'll find ways of acting out, and you do sort of hear about this in general in terms of people's reactions during the war, and seeing it play out in Los Alamos as well has been rather well done, I thought. I mean, it's just the show is continuing to do a very good job of both building up the characters, and now that they've sort of settled down from their crisis of the week in the bomb projects, or primarily on the implosion side of things, I'm just continuing to really enjoy this show. I mean, you were talking about in an earlier episode about some of the conflicts that we have going on, where we've got shows in the same time frame, and the show you might not have expected to be the the one that's your primary has become the primary, and that certainly has happened with me the last few weeks with between Manhattan and Masters of Sex, where they're on opposite each other, but it's Manhattan is the one that I want to get to first, as I'll be discussing a little bit later.
A little bit. Yeah, I feel like this show is very consistent. I've said that many times before. One thing I like about this episode was that the relatively minor character that Peter Stormare. I'm like Gary with names this week. I don't know why. But anyway, his bit character has just been a joy as it's expanded in importance. It's almost like Manhattan's version of that character from Real Genius that was living in the closet, that just kind of comes out and just leads them where they're supposed to go, theoretically and philosophically, and then goes back to what he was doing before. And yeah, it's just we've got such good character actors working on this show, and he's just another good one there. And like you said, the fact that all of these characters, the flaws and the weaknesses are starting to be exposed in some fairly stark and terrifying ways. I mean, in this episode, we don't get the full story, but we've got the Frank's wife, whose name I'm now blanking on. I want to say Helen, but I don't know that that's right.
No, Helen's the
other one, right? Okay, yeah. So but whatever it is, it's Frank's wife, who's been working in the medical wing.
Yes,
and starts freaking out with the Geiger counter, and is walking around looking at babies, mm-hmm. and then the house and everything else, and then it's just the chill. Because, of course, I believe that this is the episode that ended with the ever-increasing sound of the ticks on the Geiger counter, and it was like, oh, boy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and especially after that previous episode, sort of highlighting the cavalier nature of the safety protocols. So, that was definitely a development that as you say was chilling and made sense given what they'd set up and what those of us who study these things are aware of in terms of some of the ways waste and that sort of thing have been dealt with later, especially on the weapons production side.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see, since we already kind of started.
Yes.
Talking about that a little bit, I'm going to go ahead and move into the next episode, and I'm just going to assume there's not a promo. They've been really bad about putting them out. Season 1, Episode 10, The Understudy, An Unexpected Visitor Arrives on the Hill.
Yes,
again,
indeed.
Just a huge amount of information there. What would you give this one?
I would give this one a 9.
Okay, and perhaps appropriately, I would move that up to an 8.5.
Okay.
Once again, your highlights for this episode.
Yeah. Obviously, the visitor. I mean, Sid is Sid's wife, and her showing up and managing to track down Los Alamos, which I thought was given all of the security and obfuscation, I thought was pretty impressive. That made for another strong sequence with Richard Schiff, who I think that character has been really coming into his own. And I think we had some criticism of him and when he was first introduced with the initial interrogations, and certainly the circumstances leading up to Sid's attempt to escape and shooting. But again, I mean, you're saying how chilling, and I've finally gotten the wives straight in my head with Liza Winter's discoveries. With the way he is basically shutting her down. I particularly liked the way that they were able to work around it to at least get her a little bit of closure. As I was mentioning about the other episode, the fact that they are staying true, the way they stay true to the fact that these are intelligent people who may be somewhat socially awkward in certain things, but if they want to get something done, they can usually figure out a way to do it. And that was certainly very, very well illustrated by that. And certainly we were just talking about Peter Stormare in the previous episode, and was just his role in things is just continuing. The nuclear historian in me, you know, certainly liked hearing them finally start talking about shape charges and bringing the implosion side of things along, and the back and forth there, I thought also was very true to not that I am a scientist, but I've studied them for long enough and about the scientific method for long enough, and but the way they were going back and forth and trying to hash it out, and you know they're not there yet, but you can see the wheel starting to turn and the tide starting to turn more in their favor, which I thought was nicely done. I'm kind of all hitting on some of the other points in the episode, because for me the real highlight and what really did bring it up to the nine was after that brilliant setup of Liza with the Geiger counter making all these discoveries. And in the previous episodes, of course, with the hints they dropped about her mental issues and institutionalization, and to have it all wind up as far as we can tell, was just in her head, was just a brilliant twist and a devastating one at the end. That expression on Frank's face as he's realizing, we're at this place again. We've got to deal with this again. Was just brilliantly done. And that's why I was deliberately, when we were talking about the last episode, mentioning, you know, all the ways in which it was ringing true to me, and then just to have it slammed back at the end of this episode was just a stunning development.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was extremely well laid out, because this was a classic example of subtle foreshadowing, because there were so many reasons to just kind of ignore all those hints about her mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And for it to just come out the way that it did. And the thing that really I loved was the comment that he made about the expiration date's just a year ago, they should still be good.
Yeah.
Was like, not only is this something that hasn't been an issue for a year, he's had to deal with that before. Because he thought to look at it. And that's not something that you would do just naturally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like, this has been going on probably as long as they've known each other. You know, it might even have been something that's been going on her entire life, that every year or two, this recurs.
Yes, exactly.
And yeah, so it's like, it said so much in just that little bit of dialogue, and the expression on his face and the weariness of the way that he said it. It was extremely authentic and just worked really well, because a lot of this episode was about taking these little things that have been building over the course of the season so far and paying them off, not in a big flashy way, just correctly, with the amount of weight that it really deserved. So, yeah, I really liked this episode, and it was all the character stuff that paid off, right?
Yes.
Not only that, but like you said, the scientific side of it was kind of – you could geek out a little bit on too, because they went right to the science. I mean, because it's not like this is a big mystery. Mm-hmm. At this point, anyone could really go and look and see the scientific advancements and theories that went behind this.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's nice to see that play out.
Yeah, and also giving you that sense of That, you know, what was unique was getting all of these different players together. And so you have these contributions from this person and that person, and it really how crucial it was to get them all in that one place so they could start bouncing ideas off each other to get to the desired conclusion.
Mm-hmm. All right, what else would we say about these two episodes? I was a little bit surprised, actually, to find that this was not the season finale.
Yes.
I thought it was a 10-episode season. Oops, 12. Okay.
Yeah. not that I'm complaining.
Not at all. Not at all.
Yeah, and I guess we haven't been touching on Abby's now continuing affair, and I thought that was just in terms of the character developments we've been talking about, that was rather interesting, as after her reservations, that it's actually bringing her now to a place where she is loosening up from some of those conventional strictures that she's been living under, and I thought of, you know, and nice little reference in there to bring Camus and the Stranger, and you know, and of course her actually reading it in the original, because that part of that conventional upbringing was of course getting the years of learning French, but now using it to expand her horizons a little bit more.
That's one way of looking at it.
Yes.
Yeah. Another thing that kind of stood out for me was, again, this character whenever she comes up on screen, I always forget that she exists. But then she does something to get my attention, and that would be Frank's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember how old she is, but I'm just waiting for that to come to something.
Oh, yeah.
Because, yeah, at one point, you know, the scene came up where she's with the guy in her room or in his room or whatever, and the first thought I had was that she was one of the nurses that, you know, takes money on the side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh no. No, she's younger, number one.
Yeah.
Frank's daughter, number two. Yeah. Oh, this is bad.
That is definitely heading towards some sort of blow up in the actual finale.
Yes. That will not end well.
No.
All right, well, we are going to go ahead then and anticipate that finale for another time. Instead, we are going to move on to our quick hits. And let's see. Let's go ahead and, Edmund, if you don't mind starting off here.
Sure. We have Legends, couple of episodes here. Season 1, Episode 7, Quicksand. A Saudi prince's life is threatened during a visit to Los Angeles. Martin's investigation leads him to a beautiful female rights advocate.
Mm-hmm. And what would you give this one?
I will give this one an 8.
Okay, and that's about where I fall as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one would be?
Season 1, Episode 8, Iconoclast. Martin poses as a journalist to uncover the true assassins of Prince Abdullah. This off-book investigation leads Martin into his most perilous standoff yet.
Mm-hmm. And you would give this one?
I will go with an 8 as well.
Yep, and that's pretty much where I am right now. The show has kind of fallen into a very nice routine for me. And I kind of figured we could just talk about these two very briefly together, because they really are, it's like a two-part episode without really being a two-part episode.
Yeah, that seems to be their pattern, I've noticed. That,
yes.
You know, again, you know, this is episode 7 and 8, and it seems like, you know, yeah, they've been doing this thing, which actually Strike Back does it as well, of kind of taking each little story arc and dealing with them in two-episode chunks.
Mm-hmm. And it works really well here, because you just get into a nice rhythm with things, and I really liked the fact that I was wondering where they were going to go the last couple episodes. And what we get is this kind of doubling down on all the questions about Martin's identity,
mm-hmm.
and all this family drama that's been behind the scenes, and, you know, how that question that's been lingering in my mind, when is somebody going to realize that he's actually in an undercover situation?
Right. Yes.
And it all comes together at the end of Iconoclast. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there looking and going, this is like prelude to a finale moment, and there's two episodes left.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, okay, I see the structure here, and that's really good. And I'm anticipating what they're going to be able to do with two episodes with a situation that really kind of needs to come to a head almost immediately. So, you know, it's got a little bit of danger there, especially since we know the people behind the show and how they've occasionally let us down with a finale before.
Yes, yes.
But, like I said, the show's in a very comfortable narrative place for me right now. I know what the show is, I know what it's giving me, and they haven't done anything so completely off book to mess that up.
Yeah, I must admit. Yeah, after that that little tease of the wife's involvement, I was actually rather pleased with the way they've been playing that out. You know, I was afraid they might have gone more sort of conventional double agent, and to find out that it was his boss who she's been talking to was you know, I thought actually, you know, kept things rather cohesive, as well as bringing up some, you know, planting some doubts about a character who seemed pretty straightforward.
Okay, let's see. The next one would be, if I can actually click on the right thing here. Why don't you take this next one?
Sure. This is The Good Wife, Season 6, Episode 2, Trust Issues. Alicia scrambles to hold on to the firm's biggest client as Flora Gagos continues to struggle with an internal legal crisis. Meanwhile, Diane plots her move to Lockhart Gardner and hunts for partners to bring with her to the new firm. And looks like Good Wife is back on track. Henry gave it a 9, as did our faithful readers over at the VOG Network.
Yes, in this case, it was actually our friend Nadim that gave it the other 9. Forgot to change the name, but that's okay. The point is that we're hearing from a lot of different angles that The Good Wife is on track right now. So we'll see if they can keep that going. It's definitely up in our top 5 right now, however, which is fairly impressive. Mm-hmm. All right. A show that I was kind of curious to see where it was going to land when it came back would be Resurrection, Season 2, Episode 1, Revelation. Season 2 begins with Bellamy facing another shocking turn of events when he awakens alone and abandoned at Arcadia's outskirts, unable at first to account for a week of his life. As his memory returns, the town welcomes back from the dead powerful matriarch Margaret Langston after more than a 30-year absence. I gave this one an 8. First of all, I'd like to welcome Michelle Fairley to the cast.
Absolutely.
Well, let's just say that people who are aware of both what this show is about and the book version of Song of Ice and Fire are going to feel a bit of irony at the moment.
Yes.
That said, what's really interesting about this is that Bellamy, of course, being the FBI agent, or not FBI, but the agent that is working with, to try and figure out what's going on in Arcadia, ends up having been killed and is now one of the returned.
Okay.
Yes. That was all to the good, which is why I gave the episode an 8. The reason that it didn't have higher than that, even with Michelle Fairley coming in and really adding to the cast and adding to this tension that Bellamy's situation really brings to the table, is that the pacing is still way too slow. And also the thing that they did at the end of last season, which was introduce the idea of all of these people coming back from several different time eras, dozens upon dozens of people, and then the sheriff calling in the military to and it causing this huge problem. Well, it kind of all gets swept under, you know, into the between season rug.
Oh.
So they do explore some of the implications. It seems like anyone who was with who would be known to somebody alive at this point in time. So say, you know, Jacob and the mother and all these other people, they are all allowed to be in the town. However, it's fairly clear that the people that were out, that were kind of displaced in time, are not around anymore. What that means is that between Bellamy's situation, being a government agent and being one of the returned, and all of these other people, the government factor is still there. It's just not front and center to the same degree that I was kind of hoping it would be.
Right. Yeah.
But they weren't going to let go of the basis of their drama. One little thing that's very interesting here is that up until this point, you know, the question was, well, if people from different time eras are coming back, it must be genetic, right? Something about the people in this town, the families or whatever. Bellamy's not from the town.
Right.
So why was he one of the returned? So that's a mystery that I'm actually intrigued by, because it's like, oh, is there something about the area versus the town itself? You know, what is it? Is it the geographical area? What is it that's going on here? So and that touches on some fairly classic science fiction concepts. You know, Frank Herbert immediately comes to mind, but we shall see. But it started off well. I give it an 8. Let's put it that way. If you could take the next one, please.
Sure. This is The Lottery, Season 1, Episode 10, In Extremis, the season finale. The president announces the winners of the lottery as the mystery behind the infertility crisis comes to a head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What would you give this one?
I wound up giving this a 7.
Yeah, I struggled with this one, to be honest. And I think I wound up around the same place. I'm curious as to why you would give it a 7. I'm wondering if we kind of hit the same points.
Yeah, it was kind of continuing on from it's the way the First Lady has been handled in these last couple of episodes. I mean, from the clumsy, oh, you're just going to give, you know, I'll let you be one of the 100, but you'll just sign your baby over to me, to then what was obviously intended as the big revelation that she was in cahoots with the assassination plot, so long as Darius promises her one of the embryos. So it just seemed like a plot twist that was being introduced for the sake of a plot twist, without really being properly developed through the course of the season.
Yeah, it was very clunky. And what took away from this for me is, and it really has been the thing that has held this show back the whole time, the concepts are there. The characters are there.
Mm-hmm.
The writing was really weak.
Yeah.
There were some scenes in this episode that were cringeworthy. I was thinking just some of the ones at the very end, where I was like, clearly the cast wasn't sure how to deliver these lines because they just didn't quite work.
Yes.
And... yeah, I didn't mind it in terms of what it was bringing to the table, but I just didn't. I can't give them points for execution.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't quite there. So I mean, yeah, it's definitely a show that had its strong points, but it's also a show that needs a little bit of work. I'm hoping if it does come back, and I forget if it was renewed or not. I vaguely recall that it was, but I may be off on that one. But if it does, they need to really take a step back and look at the way that they're scripting the show.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so moving on then to a show that I think is doing a bit better in that regard, and that would be The Musketeers, Season 1, Episode 10, Musketeers Don't Die Easily.
Of course not.
A drunken Athos takes his estranged wife, Milady, hostage in the town square. That D'Artagnan knows her then causes a rift to develop between the musketeers. Or does it?
Yes.
Cue the music.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, 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 dun. Okay, anyway. What would you give this?
I will give this an 8.
All right, that's exactly where I fell.
Okay. My hesitation was actually between a 7.5 and an 8, but I landed on the 8. So.
My fingers were right.
Yeah.
Like 7.5 or 8, where is he going to land? Yeah, it wasn't as strong as I would have hoped it would be, but I think that part of that is that they weren't sure if they were coming back or not.
Right. Yeah.
And that tension kind of messed with the final act. If they knew they were continuing, they could have gone a different direction. Instead, they had to kind of hedge their bets.
Yes.
And but I will say this, that Peter Capaldi just owned some of the scenes in this episode, and just all season, but this was some really great material for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, and last one I think you're going to want to take.
Absolutely. This is Masters of Sex, Season 2, Episode 12, also season finale. The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. Season 2 ends with Masters and Johnson passing the results of their study onto the world. Ah, the ironic recap. Okay. But, I wound up giving them a slight bump from their recent travails. I would give this a 7.5. Largely on the strength of the fact that that they had finally moved towards actually treating sexual dysfunction with the supporting characters who they'd been developing and then leaving on the sidelines for the last few episodes. So I thought that was a strong and necessary development. Unfortunately, one of the reasons why it stayed a 7.5. Libby's affair with Robert was not just in her head, just to hark back to Manhattan, but was in fact an ongoing thing, which was still feeling a little clunky. We finally got to see the Master's children, who played, of course, the creation of which had played such a huge role in the first season and had been forgotten and barely seen or even spoken about, which I found a little bit strange, given the focus on them, and it would have been fine if it was being used to develop Libby's disaffection, but it unfortunately just really wasn't used that way. It was an interesting twist. I mean, the whole point of the title is, after having spent the last couple of episodes setting up CBS to be interviewing them and presenting the work, and he's got a rival out in California who it turns out is teaming with Ethan, who is played by the future Harvey Dent, it turns out because the California guy got there first and actually got on TV first, it all has to be dropped. And it turns out that Bill was actually engineering all of that because he really isn't quite ready to go public. also heralded the all too brief return of Beau Bridges as Barton Scully, who it turns out was the one pulling the strings to allow all of that to happen. So they got to have a very nice scene right at the end, which just made me regret even more that the Millers is an ongoing series.
There's so many reasons to.
In my case, it's because no, I mean, Beau Bridges can't be on Masters of Sex, and Margot Martindale can't be on the Americans as much
That's
as
right.
you like. So.
That's what I'm saying. There's many reasons. Yes. But at any rate,
at least they got back. They got back to decent by the finale. I'll just keep my fingers crossed for next season, and hope that it doesn't continue the Showtime decline.
Hopefully not, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that pretty much closes us out for this week. And again, just as a reminder, we will be off next week because I will be at Comic-Con, and apparently we could all use a little bit of time to recover from these seasonal colds and allergies and whatnot. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.